The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Hello, I'm your host, Beverly Prentice, and you're listening to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, myth, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com. Thank you. Granny Woman by Lynn Coulter. I am white-haired now, and when I run a comb across my head every morning, some of my sparse hairs catch in the teeth. When a woman grows old, her hair thins out like that, like a life grows thin and stretched out, too, touching the end of usefulness. It is a sign to us that we are to cast aside all vanities before we die. But God knows I am not ready yet, for I have much to account for. He cannot always forgive his children till they have borne the weight of their sins. It has been so since Adam and the first woman, and so it must be with me. It began with lightning. I hadn't been born that August morning when Daddy hitched his mules, Jenny and Jim, to plow the cornfield he sharecropped for old Odom. He only stopped to eat the hoe cake Mama brought for him, his midday meal. Then she, who did not know yet she was carrying me, took the reins while he sat down to rest under a hickory nut tree. It had been a thundery-like day, she told me later, hot air and still, sky low and gray. Across the field, bees droned in a honeysuckle thicket, lulling Daddy down to sleep after he'd ate. So Mama, thinking to let him rest, kept on plowing, gee-hawing to Jenny and Jim, and slapping the reins on their rumps every now and then, stinging the dust out of their coats. Storm came a-rumbling over the purple mountains. She saw the clouds grow dark as coal and roll down to the valley floor. She wrapped them reins tighter around her fists. It wasn't far to go, and she determined that that field would be plowed. Daddy drowsed as thunder rumbled in the air. The hairs on Mama's arms prickled up, but she dug her boot heels into the rocks and dirt of these Appalachian hills and leaned into the plow. Rain fell cold like needles. She seen lightning crack over by Odom's place. One more row, she thought, and the field would be done. Sky darkened then like night all over. For long she was steering by flashes of lightning. One jagged streak hit across from her, and smoke curled out of a brambly patch into the rain. She got scared then, slung the harness aside, and ran underneath the hickory nut tree, shaking Daddy's shoulder and hollering, "Come on, let us go," and then poor mules just standing out there in the middle of that field, braying and stomping their hooves for her to come get them. And about that time, the lightning hit with a crack like Almighty God himself had spat onto this miserable earth. It didn't hit that tree, though, like true lightning ought to. No, sir. It hit them poor mules, Jenny and Jim, struck them both dead to the ground, killed both my daddy's mules in one blow. There was nothing nobody could do. Mama and Daddy knelt under that tree, holding on to one another, wet leaves plastering onto their backs, and hickory nuts shaking down in still green shells till the storm passed. Then they crept out from under those branches, dripping rain, and felt of the bodies of Jenny and Jim. Burnt hair smell tinged the air. They rubbed those mules' stiff ears. Daddy pumped their sides till his arms ached, trying to squeeze breath back into their lungs. The mules' noses were still warm, but the life wasn't in them. I was born next spring, and as I grew, I learned what the lightning had done that day, what it took away, the life spirit it took out of them mules, Jenny and Jim. It gave me to give away again. The Lord giveth, and the Lord taketh away. I was christened Ellery Kay when the Baptist preacher came round on the circuit in 1881. I was eldest of eight, and when the little'uns commenced to call me Loki, it stuck to me all my days. I lived with my mama and daddy and cared for them till they passed. After they were gone, I swapped butter for chores or sewed for town ladies. Then I put my hand to herbs, tansy root, to boil for headache tea, steeped laurel leaves for a compress when bleeding won't stop. I learned without learning, really, just knew. Chamomile for stomach ailment, orris root on a pillow to make a girl dream of a man to marry, and more. Folks heard about me, how sometimes I helped women folk get babies. It was the power to give life, what the lightning had given me that day. My reputation spread, and I became a granny woman. It was the first hoar frost morning of fall that day I saw her coming up my path. Her bucket full of red jacket taters swung hard against her legs. Folks know I am fond of new taters now that I have got too old to hold my own. Her head was bent low against the wind that whistles down my mountain, heavy red curls streaming over her shoulders. I knew her to be Girly Kennedy, who had married a year before. She had not married young, as is the custom. I heard tell that her pa near despaired of wedding her away. She was not ugly, but her face was flat and plain. She was big-boned and awkward, too, with long arms that stuck out of the sleeves of every dress her mama sewed, and calloused hands at the end of them long arms. She clumped up my path in a man's brown brogan shoes, for her feet were too wide to wear a woman's slipper. But for all of this, she was strong. Her broad shoulders didn't hunch under the weight of that bucket. I welcomed her to my fire. She shrugged off her crocheted shawl like it was itching her back. Granny Loki, I am in need of your service. Why, child, what would you need of me? I couldn't imagine this big, healthy gal needing me to help get a baby. You know, I'm married to Guy Howard. Now, this did surprise me. I had not known who she wed, and they seemed an unlikely match. Guy Howard was one of the fairest men in the valley, and many a girl had set her cap for him. He helped at his daddy's peace goods store, which would be his one day. He had even given me, old woman that I am, a feeling like fingers raked down my spine, with them black eyes of his. Guy Howard wants a baby, Granny. She sat down on the floor beside my fire and wrapped her big hands around the china teacup I gave her. I can't seem to get one. I took up a lit twig from the fire and touched it to my pipe. Y'all ain't tired long enough yet, girlie. Give it a while and come back and see me, I told her. For it was true. He don't want to wait. His ma and pa is pushing at him, for he's almost 30 years old. She stood up to face the fire, and I saw her dress was patched in the back. Shameful, I thought. The wife of a piece goods merchant had no cloth for a decent gown. How old are you, girlie? 19. Then she rubbed her eyes with her knuckles and stared down at the floor. Her brown shoes stuck out from under her skirt. I ain't a pretty woman, Granny. I'm afraid he'll leave me if I don't get a baby. Awkward-like, she knelt down and laid her head in my lap, making out like she was sobbing. I rubbed her knotted curls and then shook my apron to shoo her off. I'll help you, girlie, said I, though it's against my judgment. But you drink my potion every time he comes to you. It's helped women before. She smiled up at me then, and I saw that her brown eyes was dry of tears, dry as the cornstalks burned by frost in the garden outside my cabin door. I saw her a time or two after that, for she came back for more potion, and she paid me with crops from her daddy's land, or a remnant of calico from Guy Howard's store. Then I did not hear from her again. For a while I wondered what became of her, if she'd got her baby or if Guy Howard had let it go. And finally I forgot about her. It was almost 2 years gone by before I heard of her again. I had walked to town that day for flour and coffee and spied her through a store window across the street, patting a baby swaddled in a ragged piece of flannel up against her shoulder. I asked the clerk, measuring out my flour into a cloth bag, about her, and she allowed, yes, that was Girlie Howard, and yes, she had finally got her baby. In the telling of this, she spilt a handful of flour on the wood floor, but then scuffed it in across the planking with her foot. You won't have to pay for that, she said to me. It struck me how she moved her big foot and how she spoke. Her hair, wound in a bun on top of her head, sprung out in wiry red strands from a nest of hairpins she'd stuck there. She looked at me and spoke what I was thinking. She's my sister, she said. I'm Lute Kennedy, the youngest. Well, I said, I'm Granny Loki. I helped your sister get her baby. And I said this with satisfaction and pride. She turned away from me and twisted a string around the neck of my flour bag. Here, she said, thrusting the bag at me. Don't pay me for it. I walked home that afternoon like a fool, full of myself, vain that one such as me could sow life into a barren girl. Sitting in the rocking chair on my porch that evening, I watched the sun hide behind the mountains, staining the fields all round with red. I napped till my chin bobbed against my chest. Then I snapped awake, feeling like you do when you're groping your way through a dark place and know just by knowing that something's in front of you. It was Guy Howard standing on my path. I knew it was him, and yet he looked sick, pale-faced, and eyes yellow where the whites should be. So you're the granny, he said. He stood there for a while, and then he climbed onto my porch, towering over me, breathing hard as if he'd run all the way up the hillside. Which woman? I gripped the arms of my rocker and raised up. I thought I was not afraid of any man. What brings you here, Guy? My tongue and brains were still thick from sleep. I heard you was in town today, said he, buying goods. Gossip said you was behind it. I shook my head. What ails you? He stepped so close to me I could smell moonshine from his mouth. Over the ridge the light faded, leaving his face as dark as shadows. You give Girlie that black medicine. I couldn't reason out what he meant. To get a baby with you is all. He grabbed me by the front of my dress with one fist and shook me like a dog will shake a dead rabbit. "Made me a laughingstock, you hear?" he shouted. Then he threw me back into my rocking chair and sobbed. "Got me an idiot, not fit to live nor kill." He stood there crying, his shoulders shaking under his black coat. Then he turned and staggered down the porch steps. I heard him stumbling through the brambles, and I sat there shivering till the moon rose and the crickets dared to sing. I did not sleep that night, nor many after that, and when I had called up my courage, I walked to town before dawn one day and watched until I saw Guy Howard open his store. Then I tore out to find Girlie. I found her outside their cabin, clipping wet clothes to a line hung between two skinny saplings. Something made a gurgling sound under a tree nearby. I spied a split oak basket, and that dirty blanket in it must be the baby, covered up. I called to her as she wrung out a shirt and flapped it in the air. "Girlie." She swung around like she was scared. "It's just me, Granny Loki. I come to see your youngin'." She threw the wet clothes down and run to the youngin'. She dropped to her knees beside the basket and picked up the baby, holding it close and rubbing its hair. The blanket slipped down and I saw its back was twisted a little, a shape like a garter snake will make in the sun if you rake over the rock it's sleeping under. "Let me see," I whispered. She never said a word, just looked like daring me to touch. But then she lifted it off her shoulder and cradled it in her arms. It had curly red hair, same as her, but its eyes were roving, unsettled on her face or mine or anything. It rolled its black eyes, Guy Howard's eyes, toward the sky and trees above, rolled them like it was lost in that sky. "How come this to happen, Granny?" she cried at me. "Your potion done this. Guy Howard is like to kill me for this." So it was a girl. Oh, my heart like to have broke, and I knelt down beside her. "Girlie, this ain't never happened to no one I helped before, I swear it." She moaned and clutched her bundle to her chest and rocked back and forth on her knees, not looking up and never speaking again. I left her there, the wet shirts and pants flapping on the clothesline in the wind, gray clouds swarming in the east. I feared to see her anymore. Once or twice I saw her sister Loot when I went to town, but I bought off of anybody else I could to stay out of her store. I knew they blamed me. Word came to me that Guy Howard beat Girlie and was drinking so bad his daddy had threatened to cut him out of the peace goods store. And still I thought I'd do more harm than good to see them again. Fall came. Persimmons glowed red in the woods. Under November's moon, I dug herbs before the first hard freeze. Nights I sat before my fireplace, scrubbing dirt off roots and scraping the mealy flesh for potions I'd use for the sickness winter would bring. Sometimes my hand shook and I sliced my thumb, wondering was it a spoiled root I had picked for her? The wrong herb, steeped too long or simmered too slow? What had I done to bring this misery on? It snowed hard on the path to my cabin that winter, and nobody trod upon it to break the brittle crust. Nobody brought their babies to me to treat for coop. Nobody came for a poultice for an aching limb or fever. And so I suspected nothing when I opened my door to a knock one night and found Loot there. "You got to help her," Loot said. I closed the door to the cold, but she just stood, not shedding her coat or scarf. "Him and his daddy fought today about the store. Girlie begged me to stay with her. She's so scared of him." I felt the bile rise in my throat. What can I do? She shook my arm. Tell him the baby ain't Girlie's fault. You got to help her. And what could I do? My heart was so afraid I had done this. I did not believe it was his will. It was my meddling, all mine. So I ran behind her, quick as my old legs could carry me, back to Girlie's cabin. Its door stood ajar. Inside, a lantern threw a yellow gleam on a table with cups and pots knocked askew. Something dark dripped from table to floor. Me and Lute hung onto the doorframe, taking it all in. It was quiet as the tomb inside, except for the baby's crying. Guy Howard was gone. Girlie lay on the floor, stretched out on her stomach. Crawling along the floor, the baby girl reached out to twine her fingers in her mama's knotty red hair and laughed. We rolled Girlie over. One button on her shirtwaist had broken in half, and the sharp edge had gouged her in the hollow of her throat. A drop of brown blood had dried there. I listened for her breath. Then I found a quilt on a pallet and laid it over her from brow to knees. Lute dropped across her sister's chest, screaming and crying. I was so stricken, I couldn't speak. At last, I collected my wits enough to take the baby against my shoulder to warm her. I don't know how long we sat there beside Girlie. Sometime before daylight, he came back in. Lute lay quiet now over Girlie's body. But she roused up when she spied him. Murderer, she screamed. Get out of my house, witch, he hissed at me. He looked past Lute like she wasn't even there. Striding into the room, he yanked the blanket away from the baby's face. The baby asleep now in my arms. Leave us be, Guy, I said, my voice afraid and quivering. I had stayed beside Girlie all night, and my legs were stiff and aching. I couldn't shake the sleep out of my limbs fast enough to rise, and I hugged the baby close as I cowered beside Girlie. We'll see about this, baby. Let us be. I'll kill you, he said to me, but his voice was calm, and even now. He towered over us, Lute and me and the baby, crouched beside Girlie on the cabin floor. The baby woke up and looked at him with her rolling black eyes, and her eyes circled round and round the roof of the cabin. A chill ran down my back, and I wondered, does she see her mama's ghost above us? Guy lunged down at me as if to rip that baby out of my arms, but Lute cried out like a wolf and threw her weight against his outstretched arms. He turned to fling her off, but in the motion he lost his balance. He stumbled over Girlie's still body and fell across her. Lute carried down too and falling over on top of him, clawing and scratching and screaming what he had done. I scrambled aside as they fought, managed to roll myself and the baby away from them, and stagger to my feet. Without a backward look, I ran to the cabin door, flung it open, and ran through the woods to my cabin with the baby in my arms, Lute's cries behind my back. With shaking hands, I ran inside and bolted my door. I reached up over the fireplace and took down my shotgun. If he came for us tonight, I would be ready. But he did not come. Not that night, not the next morning. I sat like a rock, not moving except to see about the baby, asleep in my bed. And by afternoon, I knew what I must do. I dumped my potions out of my carpet bag and folded up my blankets and clothes. I collected all the money I had and packed up food and the milk my cow had given the day before. And when all was done, I hitched the horse to my buggy and laid the baby on the boards between my feet, covering her with a blanket against the wind. I whipped the reins across the horse's rump, and we sped off, the buggy rocking hard toward the valley. Overhead, clouds were gathering. The air was dead still, like the eye of a storm. This was my chance, I reckoned, to escape. He would not know old Odom's place lay in the valley, empty and dark, forgotten, but I knew. I knew, too, the storm would sweep over us once the eye had passed. It has been almost a year now. I pay a boy to run to town for whatever I cannot grow here on the land my daddy sharecropped for Odom when he was alive. The boy keeps his mouth shut for an extra coin, but soon my money will be gone, and we cannot hide here much longer. I can't think what I will do except to leave this place and go somewhere else. It will not be easy, for I am an old woman, and what have I to offer but what I know as a granny woman, and how can I offer that now? He will find us. I know he will find us, sure as I know my name. I do not ask for word of him or of loot. I am afraid to know what might have happened in the cabin that night. I do not need to ask. I know he's coming for me, coming for that baby. I hear the hooty owls call his name of an evening, feel the cold of him in the wind that blows before a rain, smell his hate in the wood smoke of the fire on old Odom's hearth, my hearth now. He is out there. It is late summer now, and some nights heat lightning dances a jig above us on the mountain ridge. Sometimes the light wakes me, though there is nary a sound in the heavy air. When I wake, my heart pounds with fear. I think for a moment the light is a lantern that someone sneaked into the cabin. Come for the baby. I drape my shawl about me and tiptoe across the pine planking to the corner where she sleeps. She breathes soft and low. Lightning breaks again, and I see her dark lashes, Guy Howard's lashes, laying on her baby cheeks. I snug the quilt over her and tuck it in against the curve of her thin spine. Tonight, at least, she is safe. Tomorrow, who could say? I am an old woman after all. In the distance, the lightning flashes in a frenzy, and I feel the storm is drawing near. More and Less and New by Amy Ogden. When Yara lands on Apollyano, a dead Beguin greets her at the shuttle landing pad. She introduces herself as Ev when she greets Yara first time visiting the Beguini. She doesn't say outright that she's dead, but Yara can tell by the papery texture of her skin, the soft purple fuzz of mycelium that covers Ev's face, and the backs of her hands. She's heard the stories, even played through the zombie nun's attack, Sims, just like everyone else back home. She figured she would see a dead Beguin or two in her time here, just perhaps not so soon. Some come to visit and some come to stay, Ev says, and moves stiffly to pick up the half-empty rucksack that Yarrow threw together as she fled. She'd left almost before she'd fully decided that she needed to go. The first moment her sister's attention was occupied elsewhere, with the riots on Focas 3. A Beguin's life is supposed to be a simple one, anyway. What would she have done here with the sim suit, the glazed porcelain tea service, the electric armor rig? Take all the time you need to decide what is right for you. Yarrow stares in sick fascination at the dark red high fae under the pale skin of Ev's temples. They could almost pass for veins if she didn't know better. So it's not already too late? Ev smiles, one side of her mouth jerkily lifting a second before the other. The fungus grows slowly. It takes weeks before the symbiosis is complete and self-sustaining. She gestures ahead of herself toward the line of personal habitats, crowded side by side along the inside of the dome. One of these will be Yarrow's, and she despairs of how she'll ever be able to tell which is hers in the jumble of doors and windows. In the meantime, you may notice some strange sensory effects, phantom scents, sounds, dreams that feel real, but you have time. Yarrow follows her down the winding path into the beguinage. She expected something much older looking, like the ancient monastery on Morix, with its solar shingles and great concentric rings. These structures can't have been built more than 100 years ago. The oldest buildings have the blocky, simplistic structure of that period, with more organic lines and materials incorporated as the colony grew outward from its origins. Nothing elaborate, built for survival, first, with small comforts and community spaces only growing in to fill the gaps later. And now this simple dome encompasses her whole life for as long as she chooses, or she thinks, glancing at Ev, perhaps a bit longer than that. And once the symbiosis is complete, it's irreversible? There are drugs, but they're hard on your body as well as the infection, Ev says. The words are neither warning nor reassuring. A simple statement of fact. If Yarrow hadn't been looking for things that seemed off, she might not have even noticed the unevenness of Ev's gait, the slight drag of one foot. It's up to you to decide what you fear more, what you'll become if you stay, or what they'll make of you if you go back. Yarrow stills. No time to falsify names or travel documents. She'd hoped, somehow, that her family's name wouldn't have followed her out to this far corner of the universe. You know who I am? We know who you were, Yarrow. Ev shrugs, and Yarrow realizes that we is both singular and plural, not the greater Beguinage, but Ev herself. Then you know my sister will come for me when she figures out where I've gone. Thick tendrils of confession try to grope their way up Yarrow's throat. Her sister, the warlord, is not a good or gentle woman. Neither is Yarrow, for that matter. Docile is not another word for gentle. In lieu of self-incrimination, she says, I know too much for her to just let me go. Ev puts her hand on Yarrow's shoulder, moving her along the path again. Then it's up to you what she will find when she follows you. Over the next few days, Yarrow finds herself less confounded by the Beguinage's strange layout than she'd expected. The branching network of paths aren't as chaotic as they seem. She is never too far from a garden, an eating hall, an infirmary. Either she's learning her way around, or the first spores in her head are already at their work. In between her shifts in the laundry or the kitchens, she checks herself in her pocket mirror, watching for purple to thread its way through the fine dark hairs on the backs of her arms. She isn't used to physical labor of this sort, and she sleeps more soundly than she would have hoped. Usually she doesn't remember her dreams, but when she does, they are of the warlord's arrival in fire and fury. The burning bodies of 100 Beguinages lighting the way to Yarrow's hiding place. At the very heart of the Beguinage is a garden, and at the heart of the garden is a fungal mass, blood red and pulsing. Yarrow's wandering brings her to it regularly if she doesn't mindfully avoid it. All paths lead here. Indeed, she finds herself drawn here. When she has free time, carried either by her own curiosity or fungal thrall. If she looks closely, she can see white bones tangled deep in the fringe thick threads. One day, Ev is there when she arrives, kneeling beside the throbbing mass, whispering things that Yarrow cannot hear and does not want to. It sounds like praying, though Ev has been clear that the fungus is not the Beguin's idea of God. Communion, then, an oral meditation. Yarrow lingers on the garden's margins, wondering if this communication cuts both ways. Whose voice would the mass use if it could speak? It's not immortality, Ev says. Her chin lifts from her chest, but she doesn't look at Yarrow. Without Ev's living body, our system can't be indefinitely maintained. Yarrow swallows. Then what? Then we'll be reabsorbed into the rhizome. Ev indicates the fungal mass, and the rhizome will be more than it was before us, and we will be less. And that is Yarrow's future, too, if she wants it. She doesn't know what she wants. The kitchen mother to whom Yarrow is assigned is half Yarrow's age. It should rankle, but her sister is younger than her, too, and it's hard to muster any offense. As the kitchen mother, the one responsible for feeding everyone who lives in this corner of the Beguinage, she spends most of her time planning meals, coordinating with the gardeners, setting up duty rosters. But most days she can also be found elbows deep in the sink, or chopping capsicum, or sweeping. Yarrow imagines the warlord wielding a broom, but of course, in her sister's hands, even a broom could become a weapon. Even Yarrow could. The kitchen mother sings what sounds like hymns whenever she works, and Yarrow recognizes some of them. Soaring melodies, stolid words about the six faces of the turning god. When she asks, isn't it sacrilege to sing the songs of the constellary temples here? The kitchen mother only laughs. The fungus has its own harmonies that you can't yet detect. Sense, pheromones, that sort of thing. She directs her broom at a stubborn pile of crumbs in the corner. But there's still joy in the songs we grew up singing. Yarrow, peeling sweet potatoes, is not as mindful of her fingers as she should be while she watches the kitchen mother work. She nicks herself a glancing blow and blots the blood that wells up in the corner of her apron. What drove you here? She asks, a question she has no right to ask. And yet, our sibling pod died in the attack on Azhoshal. The kitchen mother leans on her broom, her back to Yarrow. She doesn't see Yarrow's fingers curl around the handle of the peeling knife again. Dayan was at university in the Quarak cluster. She lays one hand on her own shoulder. And so Dayan alone survived. The warlord perpetrated that attack, said Yarrow through numb lips. Yes, we know. I was there too. Yes, we suspected. They stand in silence more. Then the kitchen mother moves off again, the broom making broad strokes over the wood floor. Yarrow picks up another sweet potato, one that's almost too big to hold. I don't deserve to stay here alongside you. The kitchen mother laughs, a surprised sound, without cruelty. What made you think you ever could? Deserving doesn't come into it. Yarrow's blade tears a jagged wound deep into the potato's orange flesh. You wouldn't have said that if you'd been there on that day, if you saw the wreckage we made of your kin. No, we don't imagine so. The kitchen mother pauses to meet Yarrow's eyes. But we are here now, and so are you. The blood on Yarrow's apron dries muddy brown and doesn't wash out when it goes through the laundry. 2 weeks later, Yarrow has strange dreams. Dreams where her sister's favorite warship lands, crushing the garden next to the little landing pad, and her sister herself storms down the ramp with 20 armed guards in tow. She dreams that 100 Beguines crowd the paths down in the Beguinage, blocking the way, and that Ev stands at their fore. There are stories told about people who come to this place bearing weapons, she says. And Yarrow's sister laughs and says, Unlike some, I've never believed in fairy stories. And Yarrow dreams of the whir of plasma rifles and the stench of scorched flesh, and she dreams of big wings that fall out, but that stand up again, walking inexorably toward the warship, as they walk each day with their baskets of laundry and their bushels of carrots. And when they open their mouths, hymns rise up from their tongues on clouds of purple-black smoke. She dreams that the invaders fall back, until, one by one, they simply fall. She dreams of the rhizome and the bleached white bones that work their way outward from its heart. In the morning, the bells ring to wake her for breakfast. Ev meets her at the eating hall. What is left of Ev, what used to be Ev, and will soon be something new and more and less. Part of her shoulder is missing, a hole edged with blaster burns. Good morning, she says, and smiles with only half of her mouth. Yarrow puts her hand on the table to hold herself upright. If I spoke to the rhizome, she whispers, or if I go into it one day, will she be there? No, gently. Ev touches the back of Yarrow's hand, and Yarrow doesn't recoil from the touch. Her flesh feeds the rhizome, but her mind is lost. Today, the purple fuzz on her face has faded to gray. The red of the mycelium has gone more brown than red. Her shuttle is still here if you want it. Are you staying for breakfast? Yes, Yarrow whispers. Her hand leaves the table to fold into Ebb's. Yes, I'll stay. This is a column by Charles DeLint, Books to Look For. And his first book is Naked Brunch by Sparkle Hayter. That's A-Y-H-A-Y-T-E-R, published by McClelland and Stewart. Readers unfamiliar with Hayter's cheerfully quirky voice from her Robin Hudson mysteries might still get a clue as to what's in store for them by the title of her new novel, a cheeky play on that of the William Burroughs classic. But instead of junkies, Hayter writes about another New York City minority, werewolves, or as some of them like to refer to themselves, people with lycanthropic metamorphic disorder, or LMD. To be honest, while Hayter does spend a fair amount of time with her werewolves, in both human and wolf shape, and posits a number of considered speculations on their genetic makeup and history, I'd say she's more interested in writing a character-driven novel that just happens to also have some werewolves in it. She spends as much, if not more, time delving into the psyches of Sam Deverall, a good-hearted, if somewhat dim, reporter at a local TV network, and his co-workers. Deverall is going through a bad patch with his marriage. So is the city's mayor, as well as a psychiatrist werewolf, Marco Potenza, who runs a clinic for werewolves. Come to think of it, relationships on the edge of breakup or those that have already disintegrated touch pretty much all the characters in this book. From Annie Engel, the nicest girl in the city who, as the book opens, learns that she's a werewolf, to Jim Valenti, Potenza's rival, a renegade werewolf who was presumed dead. But none of this is delivered with teariness and angst. Hayter's trademark wiseacre voice is in full throttle here as she pokes fun at social climbers, gossip columnists, news agencies, multinational conglomerates, and anything else that happens to get in her way. What's surprising and also so satisfying is that all of this is icing on a great, fast-paced plot with characters we can really care about. Hayter has been, in her time, a news reporter, a TV producer, and a stand-up comedian. But what she proves with Naked Brunch, as she has with her mystery series before it, is that first and foremost, she's a novelist, smart and talented. The next book, The Angel with 100 Wings, by Daniel Horsch, published by St. Martin's Press. I'm not sure what the attraction is in the Arabian Nights and stories of its ilk. For myself, it combines a number of interests, folk and fairy tales, high adventure, and a fascinating, not to mention, foreign culture. After having spent a couple of my formative years in the Middle East, I find the landscape very familiar and somewhat missed, living as I do in North America's eastern woodlands. Daniel Horsch's first novel plays into all of this with the added bonus of delving into the history and practice of alchemy, another subject that intrigues me, but of which I know very little. The Angel with 100 Wings is set in ancient Baghdad and tells the story of Abu Hassan ibn Taher, an old pharmacist and alchemist who is also a confidant of the Sultan. Having raised himself and his family from small village poverty to their present comfortable position in society, he's hardly interested in jeopardizing it by helping the Prince of Persia elope with Shemselnihar, the most loved of the Sultan's harem. But what he wants and what fate has in store for him aren't necessarily the same thing, and he soon finds himself deeply embroiled in the young lover's affairs, with the danger of discovery escalating by the day and certain death waiting as his reward. Horsch brings 9th-century Baghdad beautifully to life, writing in a style that makes it easy for contemporary readers to slip into this ancient world, with an assurance that makes you feel he's relating his story from first-hand experience. There is none of the overt magic of the Arabian Nights to be found here, but the sensuous and dangerous world of djinns and magic still feels close. And while the events that move the plot forward center around the Sultan, his mistress, and the Persian prince, in the end, the book is really about Abul Hassan himself, his hopes and fears, his study of alchemy, and his growing distance from his family, his affection for the Sultan, not to mention his guilt at betraying his friend, and how, by doing so, he is also putting his whole family in danger. In fact, asked for a quick catch-all phrase to describe the book, I'd have to say it's a septuagenarian coming-of-age novel, if that's not a contradiction of terms. What Abul Hassan ends up learning, the closer he comes to his own death, is the importance of life, the importance of what he does have. Recent events aren't jeopardizing the most crucial elements of his life. That has already happened through his own inability to live in his own life. In The Angel with 100 Wings, Horsch has produced a beautiful and many-layered novel. The next book, Baden Free Library, maintained by Eric Flint. The internet's an interesting place, though I don't know where people find the time to surf it as much as they do. Perhaps they're simply better at managing their time than I am. They certainly seem to have more of it to spare. I tend to go directly to a site I want, looking for some specific information. If a search engine brings me somewhere that's not exactly what I need, I don't spare the site much more than a glance and move on. But occasionally I'll go browsing and will even be delighted in what I find. Case in point, from a link in a Fred Eaglesmith digest, I found myself on Janice Ian's website reading an article called The Internet Debacle, An Alternate View, which I highly recommend. You can find it along with a number of other of Ian's reprinted articles at www.janisian.com/articles.html. It's about the illegal downloading of MP3s and also touches on the downloading of ebooks. I put illegal in quotes because Ian makes a good argument that these downloads are actually boosting sales for musicians and writers rather than stealing income from them. From Ian's article, I was led to the Bay and Free Library. The URL is listed above, I just read, and read yet another fascinating take on the subject, this time from a writer's point of view, in Eric Flint's introductory essay to the site. He reiterates a number of Ian's arguments and then goes on to equate the availability of books offered for free in e-versions to be not much different from the way we lend books to our friends or get them from a public library. I don't know any author, he writes, other than a few who are, to speak bluntly, cretins, who hears about people lending his or her books to their friends or checking them out of a library with anything other than pleasure, because they understand full well that in the long run, what maintains and especially expands a writer's audience base is that mysterious magic we call word of mouth. Then he goes on to tell us, and just as important, perhaps most important of all, free books are the way an audience is built in the first place. How many people who are low on cash and for that reason depend on libraries or personal loans later rise on the economic ladder and then buy books by the very authors they came to love when they were borrowing books? And here's one last telling remark. He talks about how, at the present time, reading off a screen is not as competitive as reading paper. But what about the future when advances in technology might make piracy so easy and ubiquitous that the income of authors really gets jeopardized? To this, he shares a simple truth which Jim Bain is fond of pointing out. Most people would rather be honest than dishonest. Then he goes on to say, the only time that mass-scale petty thievery becomes a problem is when the perception spreads among broad layers of the population that a given product is priced artificially high due to monopolistic practices and or draconian legislation designed to protect these practices. But so long as the gap between the price of a legal product and a stolen one remains both small and, in the eyes of most people, a legitimate cost rather than gouging, 99% of them will prefer the legal product. What's the point of all this? Because really the pros and cons of free downloads and an argument that you'll probably have as much luck winning as you will answering the old question of what is sci-fi? Well, right now at the Bain Free Library, you have access to quite a large number of books, all of them free. These books have been previously published in regular paper edition, and many of them are still in print. They're not by unknown authors, although that shouldn't put you off, but by established writers such as Flint himself, as well as Lois McCaster, Bujold, Jerry Pournelle, Mercedes Lackey, David Weber, and Larry Niven. And the Bain Free Library isn't alone in this. If you have the time to go surfing, try other places such as FictionWise. That's www.fictionwise.com, where you can also find free downloads to introduce you to authors you might not otherwise know. In other words, if you have access to a computer, go ahead and sample some of these books and stories. Read them on your computer screen or transfer them to a handheld. You could even print them out, though I don't know why you'd bother with that, since the cost of all the paper you'd use would probably be more expensive than going out and picking up the paperback version. Then, if you like what you've read and want to read more, Prue Flint and Ian Wright go out and buy some of the author's other work. Let's show that this is a method of promotion that can work.